Okay, so it's February 8th, and we're doing morning hashkafa, where, you know, the fellows ask various questions, and we try to deal with them. A question is being raised, something with regard to the matter of justice, how the Torah conceives of justice, and that's a very prominent issue in the subject of the parasha of Mishpatim. Now, this is a very famous pasuk, area of the Torah, which has given rise to much misunderstanding, the concept of an eye for an eye. That itself has become a phrase, an eye for an eye. And it's interesting, because I'm not talking only about the Torah, but people at large, people in general, sometimes they use it against the Jews. For example, Christianity wanted to proclaim itself, to present itself as being the religion of compassion, as opposed to Judaism being strict justice or even revenge, which is a complete absurdity. And they cite the idea of an eye for an eye. Other people, though, in general, sometimes when a person is being attacked and has to defend himself, so very often they'll say an eye for an eye, because there's a certain recognition that people have that that's what constitutes justice. Now, anybody who's familiar with Torah has any kind of a understanding of the Torah Shebaal Peh knows that this is not meant to be taken literally. And it's not that you have certain so-called biblical scholars that don't accept the Torah Shebaal Peh, that maintain, they agree that that the Jewish courts didn't practice this type of phenomenon. Never practiced this. There are societies, by the way, that do practice this type of corporal punishment, chopping off a hand of a thief, things of that sort. But civilized people kind of view that as being cruel, primitive. Bear in mind that even according to the plain meaning of the psukim, there was no such thing when it, with regard to monetary damages. The basic approach of the Torah with regard to monetary damages, theft, other kinds of damages, is basically that the person has to restore. There's no prison terms for stealing. He has to restore. And that's even the parasha of Eved Ivri. It's the one case where a person, if he can't afford to pay, can sell himself as an Eved Ivri in order to pay. For a ganav, there is also an additional penalty of kefel. That's a fine. But even there, that's only if he doesn't confess. If he confesses to the theft, then he's free of the kefel, which is a fine, and he only pays the principal. So this is talking about a situation where a person attacked another person and blinded him. It's not talking about a situation where it happened accidentally. If it happened accidentally, so then it's a matter of ordinary damages. So the issue doesn't even come up. The point, however, is where he did it intentionally. Now, there was never a case in history where the Jews actually took out a person's eye, because it's part of the Masorah. When Hashem taught Moshe Rabbeinu the Torah, so it came to the parsha, an eye for an eye. So it means money. It doesn't mean it literally. Okay. As Rashi says, Sima ein chavero, if he blinded the eye of his friend, nosin lo demeino. He gives him the money for the eye. Of course, it's a big problem. How do you evaluate the monetary value? So there's a whole Gemara on that. Achovel and Baba Kama. But then the question is, if that's the case, so why is the Torah stating it literally? An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and so on and so forth. So the basic answer, I think this was stated by the Rav, but I'm sure it's not only the Rav, is that the objective of the Torah Shebichsav, the written Torah, is more than merely pointing out. The objective of the written Torah is not, it's not prescribing in all the details the halachic requirements. That's spelled out by the Torah Shebaal Peh. But the Torah Shebichsav is expressing the ideal. And when a person does something like this, we're involved in justice. The issue is the issue of justice. And the point is being made, I think this is what the Rav said, that an eye for an eye is telling you that in terms of absolute justice, that's the punishment that should be effectuated. That is, he should lose his eye, or he should lose his tooth. That which he dealt to the other person should be dealt to him. If that's the case, then why don't we do it? Why, if that's a more fundamental question, so why don't we do it? That's one question. But you do see, interestingly enough, that when he actually kills the person, then it's nefesh tachas nefesh, a life for a life. There, it's not taken to mean money. And there, to the contrary, we're warned, lo tikach kofar lenefesh rotzeach. There you're not allowed to take a kofar. That is to say, if somebody were to come up with money, and to all the money in the world, to pay the family, the close, the wife, whatever, the children of the one that you killed, you're not allowed to do it. You can't accept any kind of a ransom. The person must be put to death. So that's an additional issue. That where it comes to more minor, relatively speaking, wounds, so there we do not inflict the corporal punishment. There we take money. When it comes to actually killing the person, there, to the contrary, we kill the murderer, assuming that, of course, he's convicted in Sanhedrin. And we're not permitted to take a ransom. Let me see if I understand the question, though. Questions being raised as to why is this considered to be justice? What kind of justice is it? If you take out somebody else's eye, so you should be made... In other words, the question being raised that to the contrary, the way we interpret it, payment, that seems to be the better form of justice. What does the person gain? What would the victim gain if you lose your eye? It's not going to bring his eye back. So wouldn't it be better if he were to have to restore? Now, we can't actually restore. That would seem to be an impossibility. But at least there should be monetary compensation. Now, according to the way we're learning it, the real requirement is that he should lose his own eye. And therefore, when the Torah expressed it that way, an eye for an eye, but really it means money. It means to say that the money is not just money. It's not ordinary damages. But the person who's paying the money should realize that the money is in the form of a ransom, so to speak. He's kind of redeeming his own eye by paying the money, because he deserves to lose his eye. So the question is being raised that it would seem from this that the preferred method of justice is the corporal one. Okay? But yet, wouldn't you say that the preferred method is the payment? Isn't that better? We have to make a study of the Torah's concept of justice with regard to damages and restitution. I mean, Morris's question is pretty strong. Is a good. I made a case with regard to theft, for example. The approach of the Torah is completely different than our society. He's not. You can't really punish the person. There is a mild punishment. But essentially, what he needs to do is restoration. So that's the case with regard to property damage, with regard to your animal. If your animal causes damage, or today it would be your car, you crash into somebody else's car. Basically, you have to restore. You caused damage, you have to restore. Now, in the case of theft, there is an additional penalty. There you have the idea of a punishment. generally it's kefel, which is twice the amount. If you stole 100, you got to pay back 200. Even that, the reason for that is because you have another element over here, and that is that it would be lacking. There'd be a problem over here if he only had to pay back, if a person stole, and the only thing he would have to do would pay back what he stole, there'd be a problem. There'd be a flaw. What would be the flaw? The flaw would be that it would be pretty much a risk-free endeavor. So that would have the effect of maybe encouraging theft or not discouraging theft. Because a person then could go ahead and steal. Now what would be the consequences? Very low risk, no risk. If he doesn't get caught, so he's got the money. If he does get caught, so he just gives it back. What has he lost? It's kind of like the investment that everybody would love to be involved in. Guaranteed. You can't lose. You'll get your money back. Either you'll make money, or if you don't make money, you won't lose money. So that would be very dangerous for society. So therefore, he's facing a risk. And that risk is that he'll lose. He will be harmed exactly the amount that he sought to harm the other person. So there you have an additional element, the element of punishment. I mean, according to this, you could ask, if that's the case, so why is it that if he confesses, that's Asheyashin Elohim, that's only if he's found guilty. But witnesses come and testify, and the court finds him guilty, then they impose the kefel penalty, the double penalty. But if he, of his own accord, confesses, so then there's no kefel, just pays back what he stole. That is to say, the fact that he admits it, he acknowledges it, that exempts him from the knas. That partakes of the atonement, so to speak. Because the objective of the knas is to deter him from doing this in the future. But if a person comes forth, why does he come forth? It means because he recognizes that he did the wrong thing, and he's willing to subject himself to the consequences. Yeah, the embarrassment. There's a lot of embarrassment involved. And there's no need to impose the fine, because the objective has been achieved, I would say, to a greater extent. Because someone who steals, and what the purpose of the fine is, so to speak, to teach him a lesson, to teach him that it doesn't pay to steal. But that's on a lower level, because it's only because of practical consequences, because he had to pay a price, because he went to jail. But that doesn't really, that's not the highest level of perfection. A lot of people go to jail, then they're released, they go back to the same old way. It's just a momentary thing. But if he has an inner recognition that what he did is wrong, and he's willing to suffer the consequences, of course by paying back, but the greater consequences, that he suffers the embarrassment, the shame. So that's a higher level. So the objective of the punishment, which is to regulate the society, and also, there's another element in the system of punishments over here. It's also intended for the benefit of the sinner. Even when they give malchus, when they give lashes, you see that there's a number of objectives in the system. The system has a number of objectives. Of course, it's to protect the innocent person, and whenever possible, his losses should be restored. But it's also to protect society. You see the element of a deterrence, so that you couldn't have a situation where people, if they stole, they just would return. If they were caught, they would just return. That would be destructive of society. But above and beyond that, you also see that there is a dimension of kapara, of atonement for the sinner. That, for example, by malchus, for certain averos, which carry a kares penalty, if the person receives malchus, So it exempts him. Because in the course of the Malkus, the objective of Malkus is really for the person to do tshuva. That's why it wasn't just the physical ashes. It was done in a specific kind of way. And as they were doing it, they would read certain psukim of the Torah. So you see, the essence is really the musar. But sometimes the musar has to be dispensed with a greater amount of force to catch the person's attention. There too, of a nikla achicha li'einecha, it says, that you see, the idea that the person, when the person confesses, the public shame factor is a big atonement. You see that in the case of Malkos, because the halacha is that if the Gemara brings down this issue, before he's given the lashes, he's tied to the post from which he's going to be lashed. The lashes will be administered to him. So let's say they tied him to the post, and somehow or other he broke free and he ran away, and then they caught him. Is he still subject to the lashes? No, the answer is that he's putter, because the pasuk says v'nikla achicha li'einecha, that nikla means kal, he's diminished. That is, he suffers the embarrassment. So that's the beginning of the malchus. The beginning of the malchus is where he's first tied up, and it's a public humiliation. He's humiliated. So if at that point he escaped and he ran away, he can't be subjected to Malkus, because he already experienced the essence, which is the Vinikla, the humiliation. So you see from there that that's an important factor. Thus, it would seem that there are three aspects to the Torah's system of punishments. At this point in time, I mean, the Rambam has a whole section on it, which is a good to review. The Rambam in the Moreh Nevuchim takes up the issue of punishments, what the principles are. So, I mean, this is just tentative. I would, you know, want to go through that again and, you know, make sure we're hitting all the points. But at this stage of the analysis, as I said, there's the concern for the damage of the victim. There's the concern for the society, the protection of society. And then there's the concern, interestingly enough, for the spiritual rehabilitation of the chote. The implication is, in the case of chovel, where a person wounds someone else, and I think this is the way, I didn't hear the rub directly, I think this is basically the way it was explained. Because let's go back to a question that we had. If, in accordance with the plain meaning of the pasuk, the ideal is for the person to have his eye removed, so why don't we do it? I believe the answer given as to why we don't actually do it, if this is the ideal, is a very important point. And that is that it's impossible. Human nature being the way it is, it would be impossible. That is, whenever you're considering some kind of an ideal, you always have to factor in the practical effects. Are people capable of this? And it could be that people are not capable of it, so it's not going to achieve its objective. Yeah, you always have that issue with children. Sometimes the ideal punishment would be to take away such and such. Take away his bike or whatever the case may be. But given the particulars, this would have been so devastating that it would just simply, it could have more negative consequences. It wouldn't do any good. So if the objective is justice, to restore the soul, and the way to restore the soul is by subjecting him to the same thing, so then, but that's only if it's possible. But if it's going to bring out such powerful emotions and turn him into a very vengeful, angry, you're simply destroying him. So it would seem then that on one level, objectively speaking, it is the best, but you have to factor in the weaknesses of mankind. You just can't do it. So if you can't do it, then you have to shift to something else. Now, let's ask ourselves, why? Because that's what justice really is. That is to say that if a person in this situation, the sin of the person is that he can't identify with the pain of the other person. Because how can you do a thing like that? Anybody should realize there should be a certain limitation. A person should have some element of restraint within him, even when he gets into an argument, and even if he gets into a little scuffle with somebody else. These things can happen. But even when they do, if a person is living in accordance with the Torah, he's developed a certain type of sensitivity, certain compassion, certain restraint. All right, so he'll say crazy things. Sometimes you just say things you don't want. But there will be some type of a restraint. You see the case that we read later on, I think it's in Vayikra, the case of the Megadeth, that he blasphemed God because he got into a dispute with someone and he was angry and he blasphemed God. So, I mean, he got really angry and he lost control. This could happen. It's true. It's true. We're not saying that a perfected individual will never lose control, will never say things that he regrets. But even when he does so, there's got to be some kind of limitation. So that, okay, you want to hit the other person. A parent may want to hit a child. Shouldn't do it too frequently. But when you do it, you got to do it with a certain restraint. And a person who is lacking that is a very defective kind of a person. That is to say, he can't identify with the suffering of another human being. And therefore, the only thing that's possible in terms of justice, and this supersedes everything else, the only thing that's possible in terms of justice is that he should be made to experience what he sought to inflict upon somebody else. The more you think about it, and you read about the cruelties, the horrible things that people have done to each other in the Holocaust, but not only in the Holocaust. Since the Holocaust, there's been a tremendous amount of sadism and cruelty and so forth. That you could really visualize this. I mean, many, many times you've seen or read about things like this, and I'm sure the thought occurs to you, wouldn't it be good if this person himself was made to experience what he did to somebody else? Or people who have absolute cruelty towards the children, like the Nazis, the way they smashed the heads of children. Wouldn't it be good if they could be made to sit there and watch the same thing happen to their children? That would be an outrage. Well, maybe you can't do it because you'll say, well, it's true, but it's not the child's fault. There's two different issues over here. What constitutes justice from the standpoint of the criminal, and whether or not it's something which can be carried out on a practical level. So what the Torah is saying over here is that justice, the system of justice, prevails. And justice doesn't always work in the restitution factor. The restitution factor. If it were possible, that is, if the reality was that inflicting the corporal punishment is something that was, practically speaking, was doable. Let's say it was doable, for argument's sake. Then that would be the preferred thing. And all the objectives would be accomplished. Now maybe it wouldn't be accomplished directly, because you'll say, so what is the victim getting out of this? That's true. In this case, the restitution of the victim does not coincide with the justice. There's an element of justice that's beyond that. And the real justice is that the one who did it should be made to recognize the evil of his deed and to do tshuva. Now, you can say, I mean, it's possible that once the person does that, Don't forget that there are other mechanisms in the Torah as well. For example, he has to do tshuva too. This would just be the punishment. He has to do tshuva. And part of the tshuva would be that he has to make it up. He has to apologize, propitiate the one whom he harmed. Okay, so in the course of doing that, one imagines that he would definitely take up the issue. If he did tshuva, he would try to make restitution as well. So that while he's not directly obligated in restitution, there are other mechanisms which would lead to that result. So that's a different way of approaching it. So that's what I'm saying over here. That the ideal in terms of justice is that the person who committed the action should be made, because this is not a monetary thing. If it's a monetary crime, so it's treated purely as a monetary crime. This is a different kind of crime. This is an assault. This is a different type. This has to be treated differently. And it's impossible. We can't allow the person to quote-unquote get away with it. Because this would diminish and cheapen the whole idea of the value of a person's life and limbs. So in this situation, the requirements of justice take precedence. And therefore, the ideal would be for the person to experience. And that would uproot this type of a problem. If it were practical, then the needs for restitution, I believe, would enter the picture, but they would enter the picture in a different way. Not as the direct expression of the punishment. However, Lamaisa, in point of fact, the wisdom of Hashem has determined that mankind is too weak, that they couldn't tolerate such a degree of justice. So therefore Hashem accomplished it in a different way. That is to say that it now becomes a matter of monetary restitution. That's not the highest level. And the person, however, the reason why he says an eye for an eye is so that the sinner, when he's making restitution, should not think that it's a monetary crime like any other monetary crime. And he should realize that when he's paying the money, what he's really doing is ransoming his own eye. So he works on that. He tries to the greatest extent possible to get a sense of the evil of what he's done. But from that standpoint, that he should uproot that evil emotion from his soul, it's not the best, because he's still not experiencing that pain. When it comes to actual murder, that's a different situation. There is no kofar. There is no ransom, because that's the worst crime of all, to take a human life. And that's something which you don't have that problem. See, it's an interesting kind of a thing. That to have a system where you'd be maiming people, chopping off their arm if that's what they did, that's something which is unacceptable to people. People can't tolerate that. But people can understand the death penalty. That is, he took his life. He deprived him of his life. There is no monetary. There he has to receive the death penalty. You see, by the way, that many people can't accept that either. But because you have a whole big movement today against the death penalty. But that doesn't matter. In the Torah society, where the sanctity of human life and the Torah goes to such extents that lo tirzach, and then even b'shogeg, you have ir miklat. As the Rambam says, there's no sin which is treated more harshly because it destroys yeshuva shalom. So that's something which must be maintained, must be upheld. We haven't really explored all the reasons why we're determining that it's, practically speaking, impossible to carry out that kind of corporal punishment. But there's many factors, I would say. The Torah is very concerned that even when we effectuate punishments, even the death penalty, that everything is done in a manner of the greatest possible compassion. The Torah is concerned about, I would say there are two factors over here, or perhaps three. There's the effect that it has on the victim. As I said, the primary objective is to cure him from his disease. But if it's going to be too harsh and it's something he just can't accept, then it's going to make him into a bitter person. It's going to destroy him. He won't be able to function properly. If you want to, for example, the Rambam says to serve God, you have to be in a certain kind of a state, a healthy state. So to go around as something like a cripple, it may be true that on a certain level he begins to realize what he did wrong. Yeah, but then he doesn't have the ability to serve God in the same way. So we could leave, let's say, Yatas Chara Behafsedo. There is a certain good, but that the good is only that now that I realize my sin, I can, that's what the Rambam says in Tshuva, that the person could be a sinner, but then when he does Tshuva, he reaches a higher level because he redirects all his energies to Hashem. But someone who's been maimed like that may not be able to recover from it. So that the real benefit that the person should do tshuva and go on, that will be lost.